Welcome back to The Europeans, the podcast that brings you up to date each week with what's going on around Europe. And I am delighted to report, Dominic, that I have finally showered after spending the week sleeping in a tent at Glastonbury Festival.
Did you have fun? I mean, I'm kind of half envious and half really glad it wasn't me when I see these pictures of people in these disgusting tents for a whole week. You were there forever.
It was so long. But yeah, it was amazing. The music was great, obviously. And it was just really joyful to stand in a massive crowd and sing along with thousands of really happy people. Like, we haven't done that since, you know, before the pandemic. So it was really emotional. Also, there are certain aspects of it, yes, that you would have hated, like the deep uncleanliness of everything. But I did think about you a lot while I was there, because every 5 meters or so at Glastonbury, there was a stand selling your favorite Cypriot cheese. The streets of Glastonbury are paved with halloumi.
Oh, now I am jealous.
I think it's your idea of paradise. What have you been up to while I've been away living in a field?
Oh, I've not been doing anything like as exciting as going to the world's greatest music festival. I've mainly been sitting around in the sunshine in my garden. It's been quite blissful, actually.
Well, that sounds a lot more peaceful than my week, at least, which is a nice thing. What have we got coming up on the show this week?
This week, we're going to be talking about the controversial use of facial recognition technology. It's being used more and more in Europe and actually all over the world, really. For some, particularly some police services, it's a very exciting technology and is seen as a tool in fighting crime. But there are many who are very concerned about it. People who see this as a technological tool that has the power to damage fundamental liberties and our privacy. This week, we're going to be speaking to Domen Savic from the Slovenian digital rights group Citizen D to find out how this technology is being used in Europe already and to see what would change based on some proposed EU legislation in this field. That's coming up later on in the show, but first, it's time for...
Who has had a good week, Dominic?
Well, as always, there were quite a few candidates to choose from. I didn't end up going for the most obvious choice this week, which would have been the EU agreeing to give Ukraine and Moldova candidate status last week. We're going to come back to that and about what that means, hopefully in a future episode. This week, I'm giving good week to the city of Seville in southern Spain for a good idea, an imaginative policy in the face of some pretty horrifying heat waves. As you may have heard, Spain, but not only Spain, has been experiencing some extremely hot temperatures in recent years. Last year, Spain recorded its highest ever temperature, 47.7 degrees Celsius in the town of Montoro. That's almost 118 degrees Fahrenheit for our listeners of the Fahrenheit persuasion. Seville is only about a two-hour drive from Montoro, and whilst it is not quite as extraordinarily hot in Seville, it is still very hot. And while civilians are no strangers to temperatures going above 40 degrees for a few days a year, the most alarming thing is that it's happening so much more often and for longer periods of time. Actually, this year, there have been more concerning signs that things are getting worse. Temperatures have risen to very high levels earlier in the season than normal. During a heat wave about 2 weeks ago, temperatures reached 40 degrees in the Seville area. It was the hottest pre-summer heat wave in over 20 years. And yeah, it's pretty alarming that temperatures are getting so high so early in the season.
Okay, but you've given Seville good week. What's the actual good week thing?
Well, they've got an imaginative sounding new strategy for these heat waves. The headline grabbing element of the policy that warrants Seville's coveted place in good week this week is an idea to give these awful and deadly heat waves names. I think we're by now all used to the idea of storms and hurricanes being given names. Mm-hmm. And despite protests against the anthropomorphizing of everything, I think it has helped us to be aware of the approaching danger that these weather events can bring, and therefore to be able to prepare for them when we hear they are coming. This idea to name the heat waves in a similar way to naming storms, it's apparently a world first, but they will not only be naming them. These names are part of a broader strategy to help civilians deal with the heat. The city is going to begin categorizing the heat waves into one of three categories, each of which will trigger a different set of measures coming into force in the city to try and keep as many people as safe as possible.
I don't know if it's possible to like quantify this, but how dangerous are heat waves compared to other extreme weather events?
Well, they can be extremely dangerous. The policy in Seville is being developed with some experts from the Arsh Rock Foundation, where they are busy trying to help build resilience in the face of the changing climate. And their experts estimate that 500,000 people are killed each year by extreme heat. That's more people dying from extreme heat each year than by any other climate-related hazard. And heat waves aren't as theatrical or photogenic as a storm or a flood, but it is actually even more dangerous, hence why it's often dubbed the silent killer. Mm. But these experts say that many of these deaths from extreme heat can be prevented. Even if we aren't able to turn the world's thermostat down, we can be better prepared for the heat and have strategies for what to do when we know the heat is coming.
And how far in advance do they think they can predict a coming heat wave?
Well, with this pilot scheme, they're going to be working with an algorithm that they think should be able to predict the severity of coming heat waves up to 5 days before they arrive.
Okay, so that's a bit of warning at least. And what kind of measures would they bring in when they think a heat wave is coming?
Well, it depends on the level of the heat wave, where it's categorized, but measures include things like the opening of local swimming pools or water parks, and also activating a core of community health workers tasked with checking on elderly and other at-risk individuals under the most dangerous heat conditions. But it seems like one of the most important measures is increasing public awareness about these heat waves. It's unfortunate, but when there is a heat wave in a city like Seville, people need to adapt their activities to stay safe. Now, as our Spanish Rays producer Katz Laszlo pointed out to me, the act of adapting because of heat is not something that is new. Most Spaniards are used to this. I mean, look at the siesta and all these insulating shutters on windows, for example. Oh dear, doorbell. I'm not going to answer it because I'm home alone.
You can if you want.
No, they said I didn't have to.
You sure?
Most Spaniards are used to this. Look at the siesta and all those insulating shutters on windows, for example. I'll do it.
Go for it.
I'm back.
3 hours later. Do you want to explain what just happened, Dominic?
Yeah, I did that thing where the doorbell goes and it's a delivery and I put a shoe in the door to make sure the door wouldn't slam, but the wind was stronger than the shoe and the door slammed behind me. I had no shoes. I had no phone. I've been stuck outside for a few hours.
I was really worried about you. I thought you'd been attacked by an axe murderer.
Everything's okay. It's really weird spending so much time outside with like nothing, no like telephone or reading material. I really had to spend time with my own thoughts. So I'm hoping I'm going to be like really zen for the rest of the episode.
Okay. Well, that sounds nice. Where were you? I think you were telling us about Spanish heat defense mechanisms.
I was telling you that, Spaniards are very much used to dealing with the heat and having siestas and things. But yeah. Heat waves are multiplying. They're getting hotter and longer. And those adaptations to life that Spaniards are used to will need to intensify. So that is why advice is necessary. And the official advice is, please don't ignore heat waves. They ask people to, among other things, limit physical activity when there's a heat wave, especially if you have vulnerable health. Maybe don't spend hours outside gardening or try not to get yourself locked out and stuck outside in the sun. I've definitely got sunburn. And make sure you wear light-coloured clothing if you have to go out.
Mm.
I should also mention that this strategy was announced alongside further commitments from the city to decarbonise and reduce emissions. Also very important, vital if we are going to keep this planet livable on for us humans. But there's obviously only so much Seville can do on their own. Their efforts to limit emissions are important, but they won't mean that Seville in particular will be saved from rising temperatures. Wouldn't it be so much more simple if local areas could just fix their climates by improving their own local emissions, even if others in other parts of the world weren't doing that? There are obviously some localized benefits to reducing emissions and pollution in general, but sadly, countries that are vulnerable to climate change are not necessarily the countries that have emitted the most. Mm-hmm. They're often suffering from other countries' emissions. So at least for now, these kind of pragmatic solutions and strategies to try and help people live in pretty extreme weather conditions are probably going to have to be at least part of the short to medium term solution.
Okay, so not the jolliest of good weeks, but it does seem like a really, really good idea. And it's quite weird when you think about it that no one does this already, given that we name storms and hurricanes and other things like that. Are any other cities going to follow suit on this?
Well, I mentioned earlier, I think, hours ago, that it's being developed with this foundation that are trying to help with resilience in the face of climate change. And they are currently working with 7 other cities as part of the Extreme Heat Resilience Alliance to come up with similar heatwave categorizations, including in Melbourne and Athens. They look carefully at each location individually with whatever the specific local needs are. And actually, Athens, the first European city to employ a chief heat officer, announced details of their plan this week as well, without the named heat waves for now, but with a similar ranking system for categorizing the heat waves. Who knows, maybe a named heat wave will be coming to a city near you soon. For now, we know that the next Category 3 heatwave in Seville will have a name, and it will be called Zoe.
Aww.
Sorry for breaking the bad news, all you Zoes out there listening.
It's a very nice name, though.
It is. And this is yet another very imaginative policy coming out of Spain. We should be getting like money from the Spanish Tourist Board or something.
Or maybe we should just be saying congratulations, not be so money-grabbing about it. Well done, Spain.
That's true.
Good job on the good ideas.
Who's had a bad week other than me?
Other than you. Well, there were, depressingly, as with Good Week, quite a few options to choose from this week. We are following the fallout of this terrible missile strike on a shopping centre in Kremenchuk in Ukraine, and of course the horrific attack on Oslo Pride. But since developments are moving quite quickly in both of those events at the time of recording, I'm going to talk about something else, and that is the response in my country, France, to yet more bad news of the week, which is the overturning of Roe v. Wade in the United States. Even if you've been off the grid like me this week, you will no doubt have heard the news that the US Supreme Court has overturned the constitutional right to abortion. And even watching this from really far away, it's really hard to see, you know, the most rich and powerful country in the world taking such a backward step. Mm. So it's been a terrible week for women. But in France, I guess you could say that a small positive thing has come out of it, which kind of makes it confusing that this is bad week and your one is good week. But hey, here we are. But the thing that has come out of it is a proposal to enshrine the right to abortion in the French constitution, with no ambiguity, to prevent a situation like in the US, where there is room for debate over whether the fundamental laws of the country say that it's okay to terminate a pregnancy or not. And it feels really significant, actually, because French opposition MPs actually tried to get the right to abortion added to the constitution twice already in recent years, and they failed. But this terrible news in the US, I think it's been a real wake-up call on this side of the Atlantic, that no matter how rich or developed or advanced you think your country is, these rights can really be taken away, so we have to safeguard them.
It sounds like a good idea, but is the French government actually going to be able to get this passed? Because Macron didn't do quite as well as he expected in the parliamentary elections.
Yeah, right. So we're in a kind of political limbo in France right now. We had these parliamentary elections that finished on June the 19th. And in those elections, Emmanuel Macron's party, En Marche, lost its parliamentary majority, as you said. They still have the most seats in parliament, but they're 44 seats short of a majority. And as we speak, the Prime Minister, Elisabeth Borne, is still trying to figure out a possible coalition with other parties, or maybe some kind of looser agreement for other parties to vote alongside them. Uh-huh. Macron has asked her to come up with some kind of proposal by the end of the week, so stay tuned. But when it comes to enshrining the right to abortion in the constitution, it doesn't really matter that Macron's party doesn't have a majority, because the left-wing bloc in parliament, NUPES, they've put forward a really similar proposal, and they're the biggest bloc in parliament after En Marche. So together, they make up a really comfortable majority of MPs.
And what about Marine Le Pen's party, the far-right party? They've been traditionally quite opposed to abortion, right?
Yeah, they really have. Certainly back in the day when Marine Le Pen's father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, was the leader of the Front National, they were quite radically opposed to abortion. And the elder Le Pen made lots of delightful comments, such as calling for women to just carry out their function of reproduction. But since his daughter took over the party a decade ago, She has gradually pulled the party in the other direction. She likes to present herself as a defender of women's rights. And she's hinted that she personally hasn't ruled out backing this constitutional change as an MP herself. But it has to be said that this proposal is really inconvenient to the Pen. Her party was one of the big winners of the recent elections. They now have nearly 90 MPs. And some of those new arrivals are quite vocally anti-abortion still. A lot of them come from the very Catholic traditionalist wing of the far right. So for the Pen, this idea to add the right to abortion to the Constitution, it risks dividing her party just as they've had this big victory of getting all of these MPs into Parliament. The Rassemblement National would rather just not talk about abortion altogether. And you could kind of see that in how slow far-right politicians in France were to react to the US Supreme Court ruling. Just like in lots of other countries, a lot of mainstream politicians in France were very quickly tweeting about this ruling and saying what a terrible day it was for women's rights in the US. But interestingly, the Pen's party was silent for more than 24 hours. And then eventually we got this slightly oblique tweet from the party chief, Jordan Bardella, saying, no one's trying to question the right to abortion, so we shouldn't even be talking about abortion right now. We should be talking about things that need urgently fixing, like the cost of living and immigration.
Okay, so the far right might not get on board with this, but even without them, does it look like this policy could get through Parliament like relatively soon?
I think it will probably take a while because the focus right now in France is on getting a government together, and laws always take time anyway. But changing the constitution is also not as simple as just getting more than half of the MPs in Parliament to vote for it. Mm. You have to get the lower and upper houses to agree on the same text, and then you need a 3/5 majority of those two houses to vote for it to become part of the constitution. Or you can hold a referendum. But right now it does look like that 3/5 majority is reachable, at least in the lower house. So this certainly looks doable. But, you know, it's quite an unpredictable time for French politics right now. And this early momentum fueled by the shock of what's happened in the US, that could fade. So for this to happen, I think campaigners are really going to need to keep pushing for it.
Here at the Europeans podcast, our existence continues thanks to the generous support of some lovely listeners. We don't receive any structural funding from big media organizations, so it's really not that easy keeping this up and running and keeping our team fed and watered.
And with shoes on.
With shoes on. But we've got a few new supporters to thank this week. They are Gabriele Bakshite, David Craven Roberts, and Kyle O. Thank you all.
Thank you so much, everyone. We would love it if you could help us to reach our 5th birthday later this year. Can you believe we've been making it for that long?
Why?
By signing up to support us. Any amount, big or small, really, really helps. And you can pay up front for an entire year if that's easier for you. You can find all the details at patreon.com/Europeans podcast, or just click on the link in the show notes. Do you want to hear a fun crime fact?
I don't really associate crime with fun, but sure.
It's not really that fun. But did you know that 70% of European criminal networks are active in more than 3 EU countries?
Oh, that is really interesting.
It's a beautiful consequence of European integration. But it does make sense, right? Like, we live on this big continent with lots of borders, and criminals are always going to cross those borders if they're being chased by national police. Which is why, for the past 15 years or so, police forces across the EU have been sharing more and more data to try and make it harder for criminals to just disappear once they've crossed a border. So these days, if Portuguese police are looking for a suspect in Germany, for example, they can ask the German police, hey, do you have records on this person? Is there a DNA match with someone who's also in your databases? Or a fingerprint match? So that's already the case. Now there are plans to take things a step further. There is a piece of EU legislation in the works called Brum 2, and the plan is to widen the types of information that European police forces can share with each other. It includes things like the info that's written on people's driving licenses, but also facial recognition data. And that is the controversial bit. Lots of European police forces are already using facial recognition. I think Ireland is the latest country to give the police permission to use it. But there's been a bunch of cases in different countries where facial recognition has led to really disturbing consequences. Just to give one example, facial recognition has been used to clamp down on dissent. Earlier this month, dozens of Russian activists and journalists got preemptively arrested on Russia Day, identified in public using facial recognition to make sure that they didn't join any protests. So it's a really difficult thing. This technology is potentially really useful for fighting crime, but it can also be really easily misused. And here we are in Europe, creating a system that critics say amounts to one of the most extensive biometric surveillance systems in the world, by allowing all of this information to be shared across countries that collectively have more than 400 million people living in them. Honestly, I found it a bit tricky to work out how worried I should be about this, so we called up someone to help us out. Domen Savic is the head of Citizen D. It is a Slovenian NGO that works at the intersection of technology and human rights, basically fighting for a world where technology isn't used for abusive purposes. And Domen knows loads about Europe's facial recognition plans, so we gave him a call in one of my favourite cities on Earth, Ljubljana. If I put myself in the position of a police detective who is looking for a suspect, having access to facial recognition data from neighbouring countries does sound like it would be really helpful if I was trying to track a suspect who might have fled abroad. But I wondered if we could start by talking a little bit about the potential downsides of law enforcement agencies using this technology. Can you talk us through some of the examples of where facial recognition has been misused by authorities?
I think the basic issue with biometric surveillance or facial recognition is that it's not accurate, and it's been known to have been misused in several cases where, based on facial recognition technology, the wrong people end up in jail. You can look at the US, where this technology has been misused several times, but you can also look at Europe and the implementation of facial recognition technology in different fields, not just law enforcement, but also private security and other fields, where facial recognition has been known to misidentify people, put the wrong people on the hotspot, and so on.
And so under this new legislation that's being proposed for the EU, what kind of data are police forces going to be able to get from each other that they couldn't get already? If I understand correctly, it's not going to mean police in Spain being able to do facial recognition live through CCTV cameras on the streets of Poland in real time, is it?
No, we should be that lucky. I think the main issue with the PRUM2 database exchanges is that police forces in different EU member states will be able to share their biometric data they have on the books. So a policeman in Slovenia could use the Portugal biometric database to find somebody who committed crime in Portugal, in Lisbon, and then escaped to Slovenia. This actually happened. They caught, charged of rape by doing this exchange. The main issue with this exchange is that we are not so sure how Portugal, the Slovene, the Greek, the Italian, the whatever police force got the data in the first place. So how did this guy end up in a police database? Okay, if he committed a rape, okay, sure, we get that. But we've had cases in Slovenia where people were, you know, ended up in a police database just because in some instances police thought it was a good idea to basically scrape all the available pictures online. So they were scraping Facebook, they were scraping social media, they were scraping media outlets. And all of a sudden, these images of people that were just, you know, basically tagged, so you had a picture and a name under it, ended up in a police database because the police thought, you know, better safe than sorry.
Slovenia has been one country really pushing for facial recognition to be included in these plans. Why do you think your country's government is so keen on this?
I think there's several, let's say, reasons or issues connected with our push. One is that we are sitting in a nexus of refugee pasts going from the south to the west and to the north. The second is that our police force is always very, I should say, trigger happy in using or trying to obtain legal backing for the usage of high-tech police technologies. So we're not just talking about facial recognition. We're also talking about drones. We're also talking about IMSI catcher, mobile surveillance, and so on. Lastly, I think it's just the trend of times. You could say it's zeitgeist, right? People or industry being very active in pushing these technologies onto the public sector, right? As I mentioned before, it's not just police, it's also the army, it's also the private sector itself. But generally speaking, it's a combination of these reasons that I think makes, at least in the eyes of the Slovenian police force, the perfect case for them having the total access to biometric surveillance databases that they have, their own cameras, and so on.
I was reading a piece about all this in Wired magazine, and it cites figures for how many images of people's faces were stored by different European countries. That was 6 million in France, 17 million in Italy, 30 million in Hungary. And that Hungarian figure seems really quite shocking. They have less than 10 million people living in the country and three times the number of photos of people. Do you have any idea why a small country like Hungary is keeping so many pictures of people's faces?
So in the Hungarian case, it's not just the Hungarians, it's also foreign people. And I think, again, it's a combination of different reasons. One could be the refugee crisis. The second one would be this security theater that Orban is trying to throw upon its country so that it presents itself as a strong force in the surveillance capitalism area. Another one would be connections with the Chinese giants Huawei, which is using Hungary as one of its entry points that's pushing towards the center of Europe. And again, generally speaking, I think autocratic regimes are hell-bent on privacy violations and security capitalism because, again, it creates this image of a powerful leader that has its eyes everywhere. A bit like Santa Claus, only way worse.
What an image.
Yeah, way worse. And so for those of us that have been to Hungary in recent years, myself included, does that mean they will have my face on their database? And if so, how much information will be connected to that about me, do you think?
That's one of the key questions, right? Transparency, access to data, and control of the collected data, right? I'm not a Hungarian, so I couldn't help you with your questions. But generally speaking, I think one of the first steps we should all demand as citizens, as consumers, as basic people, is to have clear and set rules in terms of access to biometric data, storage of biometric data, and deletion of biometric data. I think this is one of the key issues because it sort of puts the brake on this surveillance capitalism machine that is only interested in gathering up the data, not paying any attention to privacy and security of the data, but just wanting to reinvent the wheel over and over and over again. Your questions are important, and I think that before countries decide to implement similar biometric surveillance systems in their own environment, I think these are the questions that should be explained very thoroughly to the people, to the regulators, to the MPs, before any kind of political decision is being made in this regard.
You mentioned this case of a rape suspect being caught using facial recognition, and I guess apart from the obvious concerns that there are around security and privacy and these other issues, what do you think about the potential benefits of this technology? I mean, the police would argue that it can stop crime and potentially even save lives, right? Do you see some situations in which you think this technology definitely should be used?
I mean, sure, right? So every technology has its good and bad sides, right? But the real question isn't, you know, is one convicted guilty person worthy of hundreds of innocent people being misidentified or wrongfully prosecuted? These are the arguments that the police is using, right? That the criminals are always one step ahead, that they need the power of the surveillance machine to sort of catch them. You hear them talk about the downsides and the cost-benefit analysis on very seldom occasions, right? Because I think even they know that it's just not worth it, right? Plus, you have to consider the whole procedure of chasing or getting the bad guys convicted in court, right? So you had several cases of facial recognition being misused by the police and then the case falling in the courts exactly because of the police misuse of technology. You could counter-argue that facial recognition actually helps the criminals because the police can't handle the data and then the data mishandles are being used to throw the case out in court. So the debate, I think, regarding the police surveillance and police use of biometric surveillance should take a step back and look at the broader picture. What are we trying to achieve? What are the damages we're doing pursuing a specific goal? And I think we should be able to tell, after presenting all of the arguments and all of the cases and analysis and follow-throughs, that it's just not worth it, right? It's a tool made up by private sector that is now looking for the right customers in the public sector because, as we all know, that's where the real money is.
Thank you.
if you are interested in stuff to do with surveillance tech and the relationship between technology and ethics in general, you should check out Citizen D's podcast. Some episodes are in English, some are in Slovene. The guests are always great. Check it out. What have you been enjoying this week?
I stumbled across something quite fascinating on the internet. In fact, brought to our attention by our loyal listener, Gabriella. She shared a link to this new technology designed by a Swiss typographic designer, Renato Casut. It's something called bionic reading. And I think it could potentially be a game changer for me anyway. It is technology based on the concept that your brain reads faster than your eyes.
Oh, and it's this thing.
Yeah, exactly. And it's designed for those of us who spend a lot of time in front of our computers reading and tiring our eyes out. It's quite a simple concept, but basically what bionic reading does is it makes a few letters at the beginning of words bold, which in theory then helps your eye glide over the text more easily, whilst your brain remembers the previously learned words. And it means that your eyes don't have to look at every single letter in every single word. For me, it works. I notice that my eyes skip through the text happily and I can read more easily. I was actually surprised quite how much it helped. But it's not the case for everyone. I sent it around our team and it didn't do anything for you, did it, Katie?
No, nothing happened and I felt really sad.
Well, it's interesting.
Is my brain broken?
I've spoken to other people for whom it didn't do anything and some who it did work. So I'm intrigued to hear what our listeners think. So I will post a link in the show notes and I'll post it on our Patreon Facebook group to see what everyone thinks. And we can have a nice little chat about it.
Fun.
And also, since I've been locked out of the house, I just was speaking to my brother and he said that there's apparently a really good episode of Off Menu, this podcast from British comedians Ed Gamble and James Acaster, where they are interviewing, I think it's Nicola Coughlan, who's from Bridgerton and Derry Girls. And apparently the doorbell goes off during that episode, just exactly as what happened to me, and she disappears from the recording halfway through. And because there are two of them, they just carry on making the podcast without her, and apparently it's quite hilarious.
Oh.
So I'm glad I'm not the only one that this has happened to, and maybe me and Nicola should like meet up and start a support group.
It can happen to the best of us.
What have you been enjoying, Katie?
I would like to recommend some Ukrainian bands that played at Glastonbury over the weekend. Did I mention that I went to Glastonbury Festival?
Yes.
Anyway, there was a lot of solidarity on show for Ukraine among the crowds. Loads of blue and yellow flags. Paul McCartney came back on stage after his set waving this absolutely massive Ukrainian flag. And there was some really great Ukrainian music on the lineup. A really cool folk band called Deka Braka, who I hadn't heard before. They combine traditional Ukrainian folk singing with instruments from everywhere. African instruments, Indian instruments. So it makes a really cool and unusual sound. They were joined on stage by your favourite Eurovision winner, Dominic, Jamala.
Jamala!
She was there. Eurovision's winners from this year were also there, Kalush Orchestra. But I think my overall favourite act at this year's Glastonbury, or definitely one of my top three anyway, was Go A, who are an extremely fun rock band from Kyiv, who combine these like very ethereal sounding vocals and flutes with incredibly heavy pumping bass. It was a completely mad show and the singer Katerina Pavlenko ordered this huge crowd to hold hands with each other and start dancing around in these massive circles, which was really chaotic and fun.
Cool.
Probably not for everyone, but I loved it. And yeah, it was just great to see so much love and support for some great Ukrainian music. You will find links to all of those bands in the show notes.
Ha! having good colleagues and a good relationship with your colleagues is obviously important and great. I have wonderful colleagues here at the Europeans, for example, and it makes the creation of this podcast much more enjoyable than it would be if we hated each other.
Oh, it's nice to hear you say that. You're definitely not being forced to say that.
No, I'm not. You can insert a vomit sound effect here. Anyway, I say that all because I saw a video this week of two colleagues, two cyclists on a team together who seem to have an extraordinarily good working relationship. The Polish cyclist Rafael Majka and his Slovenian teammate Tadej Pogačar were cycling the fourth stage of the Tour of Slovenia, and as they were approaching the finishing line, they noticed they were a good stretch ahead of their next competitor. But one of them had to win, and instead of doing a final sprint between the two of them, they decided to choose who would cross the finish line first in quite an unconventional way. They played rock, paper, scissors. Drama ensued. Pogačar chose rock, and Majka was victorious with his choice of paper, and therefore his teammate allows him to edge ahead across the finishing line, but still while they have their arms around each other. I thought it was a really fun, sweet way to see a team working together.
That's adorable.
It really is. And it's especially touching because Majka, who won this round of the race, is the less experienced or the less successful of the two in the team. And his teammate Pogačar actually went on to win the whole tour. But Majka came second, so they got to stand next to each other on the podium as well.
Yay!
A truly happy ending for once.
You say you have nice colleagues, but I'm not sure I'd do that for you, you know.
No, I don't think you would either.
Just push you over, leave you in the mud. We will be back next week. If you need a fix of the Europeans between episodes, why not dig into our back catalogue? There are loads of episodes about all sorts of things in there that are definitely still relevant, even if they're from a few weeks ago. You can also find us intermittently posting on social media. I think, Dominic, you might have posted that lovely cycling video.
I did, yeah. You can find us on Twitter at EuropeansPod, on Instagram at EuropeansPodcast, where there haven't been any Glastonbury pictures, which I've been very disappointed about.
There was no internet. I'll post a few this week of my favourite Ukrainian Glastonbury performances.
Please do. You can also send us an email, hello@EuropeansPodcast.com. And of course, come and support us on patreon.com/EuropeansPodcast.
We were produced this week by me and Wojciech Oleksiak. Our other producer is Kat Laszlo,
who very kindly helped read through my notes about the heat in Spain, because she's an expert in Spain and an expert in heat.
She's an expert on everything. We are members of the Are We Europe audio family. You can find more like-minded European podcasts at the link in the show notes.
Bye, everyone.
Sivirimo.